Good afternoon. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, and distinguished lecturer emeritus from York College, City University of New York, welcoming you to the September 7th Black Labor Day edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM. That's WBAI on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with YCRadio.org. Well, again, we're going to have a Black Labor Day edition of Vantage Point today. Joining us very soon will be Bill Lucey, the founder of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, to talk about the challenges and opportunities for Black labor. And then Bill Fletcher will join us near the bottom of the hour. Bill Fletcher, of course, used to be on our sister station, WBAI, but he is a veteran labor and social justice activist of long standing. And so we're going to have a robust discussion about the challenges and opportunities for Black labor. But first and foremost, let me just respond to the appeal by our program director saying that we need to raise $8,000 a day for the next several days, that we need to raise $50,000, I think she said, in the next few days. And so, you know, I'm really not the best at figuring out how to pitch and so forth, except to just earnestly say that obviously WBAI is incredibly important, and we do not want to face the situation where those who have been conspiring to take over the WBAI have any excuse to try that again. And so it means we have to dig deep, and it's very difficult because people are already digging deep, and it's the era of COVID-19. All those things are afflicting us. But nonetheless, we have to do what we have to do. Extraordinary times require extraordinary effort. So I'm going to start it off today. As soon as this evening, I made a note to myself after I get finished doing some family activities. I'm going to go to give2wbai.org, give2wbai.org, and I will make a donation of $300. I will make my donation. This is the professor. I will give my donation for $300. Now, the challenge is there may not be people out there who can do $300. I can't really afford it either, but I do what I have to do with various other organizations and institutions because that's the way I need to model my life. So there may be people out there who can do $100. There may be others out here who can do $50. There can be $25. Based on the appeal of the professor, I would appreciate it if you would call WBAI right now, 516-620-3602, and say, I heard it from the professor. I appreciate Vantage Point, the program that we do, and I want to sustain WBAI, and I want to sustain Vantage Point. So call 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. I'm putting $300 on the line. I'll be doing that later on this evening on my credit card. And you can call and you can do it by whatever means. You can do it by check, pledge. You can pledge and then pay it by check, credit card, however you want to do it. But please, folks, be responsive. I'd like to also just quickly say that the census has been extended. That's a good thing. There are people trying to block the census. And I keep telling you, anytime they're trying to block something, particularly given Agent Orange, that means we should be doing it. And also do early voting. Mail your ballot early, please, because these folks are, again, trying to block us from voting. And finally, I always say, as we're saying across the station, take care of each other. Let's be responsible to each other. New York has done a reasonably good job, you know, of wearing masks and being in charge and modeling for the nation. Let's continue to do that. I'm very proud when I go out and see the vast majority of people in New York are wearing their masks, doing the social distancing, and we assume they're doing the other things as well, which is washing your hands frequently. I'd like to also just say that we're going to have, Institute of the Black World 21st Century, a very powerful program this evening. That program will be, it's going to be entitled The Theft of Black Labor and Extraction of Wealth, How the Oppression and Exploitation of Black America Built Capitalist America. And my two guests, Bill Fletcher and Bill Lucy, will both be on the program this evening. It starts at 7 o'clock. So dial in or go to the IBW website, ibw21.org, ibw21.org at 7 o'clock. And you will see this powerful program, which will also feature Dr. Julianne Malvo and many others. It really is a powerful program. 7 o'clock this evening, tune in. Well, we want to get our conversation started today with someone who is a favorite, someone that I've known for many, many years. And he's a favorite because he's one of the great labor leaders of our time. And yet he is very humble, very self-effacing, always willing to be helpful. And he will be actually welcoming people to our forum this evening. And that is none other than Bill Lucy. Bill Lucy, welcome to Vantage Point.
Wow, thank you very much, Ron. My pleasure.
All right. Well, Bill, again, we thank you, too, for being a part of our Black Labor Day forum this evening. And I wanted to spend some time with you today. But one of the things I wanted to do, Bill, was talk a little bit about your background, because what happens is we work with each other for years and years and years. And sometimes it just dawned on me the other day. I don't know whether Bill has always been in Washington, D.C. I doubt it. But tell us a little bit about yourself. Where were you born and a little bit about your upbringing?
I'm from the blues capital of Memphis, Tennessee, originally born there, grew up in California in the Bay Area, moved from there, as a matter of fact, when I left Richmond, California, the second time I'd been out of my zip code, left there, moved to Washington, D.C. in 1967, and became a part of the organization of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and spent my adult time right here in Washington, D.C. as a part of the American labor movement. I think we met early on in Gary, as a matter of fact, as we were pursuing the Black Political Conference in Gary, Indiana, in 1972, if memory
1972, that's true. And well, Bill, tell us a little bit about, though, what sort of inclined you to become involved in labor. You know, I know some people grew up in labor families, you know, they're just following suit and so forth, but what was it that sort of, you know, got you engaged in the labor movement?
Well, Ron, you know, I worked for a county in California, Contra Costa County, which is just north of San Francisco, and worked there for 13 years. And as a part of that experience, I really got an understanding of how the you're treated if you're not a part of some organization that speaks for your interests and represents your point of view and looks out for you in the context of wages, hours, and working conditions, and a voice for you in your relationship with your employer. And as a part of that experience, I got sort of firsthand, you know, a view of how the system is organized to make sure that workers don't have a voice in the issues that affect their daily working life. And it sort of grew on me and became a part of organized labor and began to understand the role that labor has a responsibility for beyond just wages, hours, and working conditions. And that was really the catalyst of my coming to work back here in Washington, D.C., the fact that we were really trying to talk through the issue of how public sector workers would have an opportunity to have a voice on behalf of themselves and others like them with their employers. And there was the notion that local government or governments in general are a sovereign entity and have no responsibility or obligation to consider the well-being of its workers. I mean, if you work there, you just do like you're told. Well, that's not a pleasant environment to work in. So I came back to work here in 1967 as a part of our union's effort to gain a little bit more influence and a little bit more voice, and certainly a seat at the table as the federal governments and state and local governments took part in making decisions that affected how we made our living.
And Bill, talk to us a bit about the importance of the labor movement to Black people. And I know there have been many challenges, and we want to talk about that as well. But, you know, over the years, you know, I guess many years ago, I've come from a labor family. My father was a shop steward with the United Mine Workers in the days of John L. Lewis. And then from Beckley, West Virginia, into Youngstown, Ohio, a steel town. So, I mean, labor was always, and, you know, you supported labor. But, you know, today one gets a sense maybe that perhaps how important labor and the labor movement is to Black people has somewhat maybe dissipated some. Would you talk about that?
Well, you know, Ron, I heard the other day that they said if the rich people are against something, that's what you ought to be for. Well, when you stop and look at organized labor, I mean, it is our first line of offense and our last line of defense against those who will exploit us, take advantage of us in every way that makes life worth living. And we as Black workers, going way back when, was really conditioned to resist organized labor on the theory that organized labor would interfere with the relationship between us and our boss. Well, nothing could be farther from the truth. I don't care what you do, you need to be a part of something that's going to speak up for you when the employer can take unilateral action against your interests. And for Black workers, we are now becoming a part of a programming process that gives us voice. And what essentially, as I said before, our last line of defense against what's happening to us. We can see key industries that we were brought into started at the bottom, and now we're seeing major changes take place where there's Black labor leadership across the spectrum that's having voice and impact in key areas of the economy. And we have now, like, for instance, Brothers in the United Auto Workers, which was a powerful union years past and still is. In the building and construction trade, as you're seeing brothers moving up to the top as presidents and secretary treasurers of major unions. I myself served as secretary treasurer for my union for 38 years. And we're seeing it in the retail trades and the agricultural industries, United Food and Commercial Workers. All of those industries, which are now we're designated as essential workers, even in this pandemic, those were jobs that were poor jobs to start with. Organized labor has a part of its role to take bad jobs and make them better, to make the wages better and the conditions of employment better. So we've got to figure out how we really convince the powers to be that we've got to organize more people in places where there's weakness in the labor force, so that we can begin to build an economy that workers can have a reasonable chance at a decent life. And for Black labor, I mean, we're right now really seeing the real value of the experiences and lessons that we've learned. As we look at, Ron, the political landscape, Black labor have moved to the front and making sure that social justice and the issues around, you know, health care and all of the key things that are key to a decent life, those are on the table as an agenda. And I think we've got a lot of work to do. We've got a lot of bad practices from the past to overcome. But the future is bright for organized labor in general and Black labor in particular.
Bill, one of the things I wanted to go back and just talk about in terms of labor history, because you're talking about, you know, the advances that are being made and Blacks rising up through the labor union. But early on, you talked about maybe some suspicion or some concerns. And to what degree was that those concerns related to the reluctance on the part of some labor organizations to even admit Black people? And then once you were admitted, the fact that it took quite a battle actually to climb up the ladder to these positions of leadership because of internal discrimination, even inside of these labor unions, which, as you said before, were so essential to Black people moving forward.
Well, ain't no question about it. I mean, the American labor movement was a difficult, was then and still is a difficult nut to crack, because the power of organized labor is essential if workers in general, and Black and workers of color in particular, are going to be able to achieve anything. So in the long and the deep past, we were kept out. Or we were given less than meaningful roles. But as time goes on, and as we not only understand the value of labor as an institution, but figure out how to achieve power within that and advance ourselves in roles that have great meaning, then we begin to see the value of it. Organized labor is just absolutely essential if you're going to have any meaningful life in the future. And you have to have that as a vehicle to challenge the authority of capital. And it's an institution that we've simply got to figure out how to make the most of our presence in it. And simply because we couldn't do it 100 years ago, don't mean we can't do it now and should not do it now.
Bill, the creation of the establishment of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, in some ways it sounds like this need to both get Black people in the unions but also to fight for strategic positions in the union, as well as adding to it the sort of social justice, racial justice agenda. Was that sort of the impetus for the founding of the CBTU?
Absolutely, absolutely, Ron. You know, we and others like us, I mean, we were not the first ones to think of it, but we were one of the first ones to go at it in the way that we did. In the past, you know, Mr. Randolph, A. Philip Randolph, created the Negro American Labor Council. And his was an effort to bring up the role and importance of Blacks as not just workers in our economy, but as leaders in certain industries within our country. So he fought that fight, and many joined that. Our frustration, and when I say our, I mean the Coalition of Black Trade Unions, was that organized labor did not reflect the deep concern and commitment that Black workers had to organized labor. And our political influence, our work ethic, all of those were not brought into the decision-making process. And I guess the straw that broke the camel's back came in 1972, when we had a real display of the lack of political concern for the well-being of Black workers and workers of color. And as you remember, Ron, that was the presidential campaign between Richard Nixon and George McGovern.
Yes.
The American labor movement took a position of neutrality after we had spent 4 years under the rule of Richard Nixon, you know, where, you know, he in effect created an atmosphere where every ad hoc racist you could see could act out. Well, come 1972, I mean, we as Black workers, you know, could see the difference between a George McGovern and a Richard Nixon. And neutrality was not something that we could even talk about across our community. And then, as now, the Black community was the underpinning of the Democratic Party. And what we simply said is that, you know, you got a right to be what you want to be, but we cannot sell this kind of a sense, this kind of an issue. So we said we had to have a voice in this process. I mean, those who participated in these decisions, they got to hear from us before they make a decision like that. So we started a movement to follow on to what Mr. Randolph had said, and that is, you can't do anything without organization. And we have and the A. Philip Randolph Institute is still in business now, and so are we. and we were both advocating for the building of strength for a black labor force that gives it not only economic power, but gives it political power. And the results are clearly indicative that not only was Mr. Randolph's view the right view, but the approach to it that we had was equally true and effective. And we are building power inside of the American labor movement in various unions.
Right.
I came out, as I said, around the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, an organization of 1.6 million active members in our cities, our counties, and our state governments. We've had tremendous economic progress by workers of color. But they've managed to achieve positions that give them the ability to have influence far beyond their numbers.
So, Bill, finally, would you talk about the role that the CBTU played in helping to advance the Martin Luther King Day holiday? Because I remember year after year after year, we always knew, you know, where you were going to be on April 4th or thereabout. And that played an instrumental role, working with Congressman John Conyers and so forth, and finally getting the national holiday.
Well, you know, Ron, the two things, maybe three things, that we're most proud of is the fact that we fought to join the civil rights movement and the trade union movement, because there are two movements with one goal, and that's to improve the quality of life of everybody. Well, you know, John Conyers, who just was a tremendous representative, not just of his congressional district, but the broad black community and the movement towards progress as a whole. And we, through our resolution and public policy process, signed on to the effort to make King's holiday a national holiday. It took a lot of time, but we achieved that. But equally important, Ron, is, you know, years ago when we just talked about the evils of apartheid and the fact that we had a national government that aligned itself with the white supremacists of South Africa, and to take on this issue and to change the course of history, the Coalition of Black Trade Unions simply said, we cannot have a global policy that by any stretch of the imagination reflects our interests, so long as you have an accepted process of white supremacists in a nation such as South Africa. So the African National Congress and the struggle of Nelson Mandela, we bought into, because if South Africa could be made free, the power of an industrial nation like South Africa contribute to benefits for African Americans here and other nations across the diaspora. So we bought into that, and we made apartheid an evil that was supposed to be isolated across the globe, and we succeeded in doing that.
Right.
And so it's these kinds of things that black labor can and must continue to do, because we are, in effect, the saviors of labor in general.
Well, Bill, one of my fondest memories, you probably have forgotten about it because you've done so many things, but I asked you and I went to jail together. Because of sitting in at the South African embassy in Washington, D.C. And I was among those that day that got arrested, and you were among them as well. So I know how strongly CBTU felt about the issues in South Africa and engaged with the labor movement on the ground there. So really, really great accomplishments. So Bill Lucy, thank you so much for spending time with us today. And our audience, again, we want to remind you, you'll be able to see Bill Lucy again this evening on the forum that will be at 7 o'clock. You go to the IBW website, ibw21.org, in the order to connect. So thank you so much, Bill. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, Ron. You take care and be well.
All right. Thank you much. Okay. All right. Again, this is Black Labor Day. We're focusing on black labor today. And Bill Lucy, one of the great labor leaders of our time, without question. and someone who's always been approachable and amenable and somebody that we could always work with. And I'm proud to have known him. He agreed readily to be a part of the Black Labor Day Forum that we're having tonight. And I do remember being arrested at the South African Embassy in Washington, D.C. I don't remember who else it was, but I know that Bill Lucy and I were in the same jail cell. And so that was quite a privilege. Well, next we want to turn to someone who is really a regular here on Vantage Point. We typically talk to him as a part of our dream team with Earl LaFry Hutchinson about elections, but Bill Fletcher is a veteran labor and social justice activist, former president of the Trans-Africa Forum, but also played a role as assistant, I think, to the president of the AFL-CIO. We'll talk about that within a minute, because I want him to share how interesting that experience may have been. So, Bill Fletcher, welcome again to Vantage Point.
Hey, thank you very much, man. Happy Labor Day.
Same to you. You know, Bill, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Bill Lucy, because the more I think about it, I said, wait a minute, and maybe I did this before, but I'm getting old, so perhaps I forget. But I've known you for forever, like a long time. And for as long as I've known you've always been the person that we identified doing labor. I mean, you talk of labor, Bill Fletcher. So, Bill, so where were you born? And what, tell us a little bit about your upbringing and what predisposed you to become involved in this whole effort, not only about engaging labor, but studying it and teaching it and so forth.
Well, I guess first I was born and raised in New York City and went to high school in Mount Vernon. So I consider myself, blood-wise, a New Yorker. I grew up in a family that was very progressive and very pro-union, but never looked at labor as a panacea. I mean, one of the things that I've written about, Ron, is that there's a critical image that I have of my father saying to me, on more than one occasion, he said, there's two kinds of unions in this country. There's the corrupt, mobbed-up unions that we see, particularly in the building trades. And then he said, and then there's the real unionism of Harry Bridges and the West Coast longshoremen. Mm. He's talking about the International Longshore and Warehouse Unions. And I'm telling you, I was knee-high to a duck, and my father was saying this to me. And his distinction between these different forms of unionism was really very fundamental to who he was and to who my mother was and still is. My mother's still alive. Because with my father actually had been a member of a union that was mobbed up, and it was controlled by the mob. And the interesting thing is that for some people, that would have turned them away from unions. That never turned my father away. I mean, he didn't go with the mob, right? But he didn't allow that to turn him against unions. So that was one very significant part of how I became what I am. A second significant part was that when I became radicalized, I was very influenced by the Black Panther Party and their attention to Black workers, particularly in the beginning, before they got into the whole lumping thing. But their attention to Black workers. And then the third piece was when I went to Harvard undergrad and I met Professor Ewart Gunear, who was the chairman of Afro-American Studies, father of Lonnie Gunear, who had been a important trade unionist in New York in the 1940s. And he taught Afro-American Studies, as it was called there, from a perspective of race and class. It was about social movements. So all of those things gelled together. And for me, getting involved in the labor movement, like a lot of other leftists in the 1970s, just made a lot of sense. But also for me, I felt like black workers are in unions. I need to be there.
Mm. You know, Bill, it's very interesting because for many, many years, I'm glad to hear how you were in Boston, because we used to think of Bill Fletcher Boston for some reason or another early on. So how long did you spend, how much time did you spend in Boston, Ashley?
Well, I was in Boston. You know, it's interesting that you raised that, Ron, because I was in Boston, in the Boston area, from 72 to 90, but there was another Fletcher in Boston who was very central in the labor movement, and that was Leo Fletcher. And we eventually met in the, like, mid to late 80s, and we're not related. His family came out of Nova Scotia, you know, the black folks that left after the American Revolution. Nova Scotia. And Leo was very involved in efforts to desegregate the building trades through the United Community Construction Workers. And then he sort of, it's not that he disappeared, he just sort of fell back. And then I got very involved both in the issue of the building trades as well as other parts of the labor movement. And so I would say I probably got, my involvement with the labor movement is probably broader than Leo's, but Leo was a hero. You know, he was a very important figure in fighting the racism that existed in the building trade.
Right. Well, that brings me to my next question, Bill, and that is this sort of difficult relationship that black folks, black workers, people who have sort of recognized the need to organize themselves to navigate and negotiate with the bosses, and yet sort of having conflicts with white workers who either were ambivalent about them or accepted them, but then would not give them sort of equal status and so forth. So talk to us a bit, Bill, about this difficult relationship, though ultimately empowering relationship that black people have had with the labor movement.
Well, it's really interesting because there's a way that the history of organized labor has been taught that makes it often appear that we as black folks were add-ons, and that there was this labor movement, and then all of a sudden we came along and maybe we played some role, but we weren't always significant. And that completely misses the real history. The real history is that the labor movement started in the 1600s when Europeans and Africans were forced to come here to labor, and Africans ultimately were converted into racial slaves. And the forced labor in the beginning were indentured servants, African and European, who frequently joined together and fought oppression. That's when the labor movement actually starts. Now, when racial slavery becomes codified, links between Africans and the Europeans really diminish. There are certain exceptions, like a relationship that we had with the Irish before the Irish became white. And so there were these, but there it was generally after, by the beginning of the 1700s, that African labor revolted in what people think of as slave revolts. So the labor movement begins in the 1600s in North America, and it included us. We were central to it. Now, in the 1800s, these organizations start to get formed called trade unions, and sometimes central labor unions, and there were other terms. And these were formed in the North. They were formed by white workers, men and women, and they excluded Africans. They excluded Latinos. They excluded Native Americans, of course, and Asian. After the Civil War, when we have emancipation, the situation changes in some dramatic ways, because like in the South, the freed African labor starts organizing on their own. In 1866 to about 1868, there were all of these what we'd call wildcat strikes of freed African workers who were now, were on plantations, were shipyards and other places in the building trades, and were striking to improve their conditions. Had a very, very important role in the Reconstruction. What's important there, Ron, is that to understand that this was done by freed African labor. They were starting, in effect, their own labor movement. Right. That included also something called the National Colored Labor Union or the Colored National Labor Union. And then there were also other organizations like the Knights of Labor that organized freed African labor, but in the case of Knights of Labor, would not organize Chinese. So there were these formations that start all around the country of different parts of the working class. And so the official organized labor was white, but it wasn't the entire labor movement. The entire labor movement needs to be understood as these different components. There was the white, there was the African, there were the Mexicans, and the indigenous, and there were Asians. And sometimes these formations, ethnic groups would overlap and fight together on the same side. This is what shaped this labor movement. The white section of the labor movement was always divided around the issue of the color line. And I would argue it continues to be divided over that in the sense of many of the leaders and members of white organized labor think that the labor movement is a white thing to which they're inviting us to participate, or sometimes that they're forced to accept us, as opposed to recognizing that these different segments of the working class have actually either together or separately helped to build a labor movement, you know, since the Civil War.
Oh, wow. That's really, really very instructive, because the history is never, well, I don't say never, but seldom is it really taught from that perspective. Pointing out that we were not add-ons, that from the very beginning, we were building and contributing to this labor movement. Exactly. Bill, I was really fascinated, and people will get a chance to hear you tonight, as you begin to talk about some of the current challenges and opportunities in relationship to the labor movement in general, but black workers in particular. I mean, I was just really, really, I thought it was very thoughtful and deeply analytical to talk about missed opportunities and where we are now in relationship to where the economy is and what the new vistas for opportunities might be.
Well, you know, I appreciate that. And to give your listeners a sort of glimpse, one of the things that a lot of people, including black folks, don't recognize is that of the different demographics in the United States, as a proportion, we're the most unionized. That is, a greater proportion of African Americans are unionized compared to other groups. I think it's somewhere between 16 and 18%. The second thing is that something that any good organizer will tell you, which is that African Americans, and particularly African American women, are the most pro-union of any demographic. And there's really interesting stories that come out of the 1930s and 40s, when the Congress of Industrial Organizations was formed and as a split from the American Federation of Labor. And when they were doing a lot of organizing in the South, I remember reading these reports where white organizers would send letters asking for direction from their leaders, because they'd say all of these black workers, they call them Negro workers at the time, but they said all these black workers want to join the union. What should we do? And it was for them mystifying, because they were deeply afraid, the organizers were, white organizers, were deeply afraid that all these black folks signing up for the union was going to chase the white folks away screaming insanely. Now, there were leftists within the CIO that understood very differently the importance of organizing black workers and the impact that that could have overall. And one of the things that they did, or I should say, one of the areas where there was yet another split, was that many of the workplaces that were where the unions went to organize were very segregated, like steel mills. And the African Americans and the Chicanos particularly were in very dangerous and low-paid occupations. So when the unions were elected in, the problem that immediately arises is, what do they do about segregation? And do they take on segregation or not? So within the United Steelworkers, there was a dominant tendency to avoid taking on segregation in the workplace for fear that it would alienate the white workers. So on the one hand, once they succeeded in unionizing any of these places, the living standard for everybody would go up. But what it meant was that there still was this racial differential in treatment within the steel mill.
Right.
So you'd still have, right, the African Americans and Chicanos underpaid or in dangerous conditions. They would just be making more than they had made in the past. There were other unions, like the packing house workers and some others, that directly took on race and fought to desegregate the workplaces. So there was this constant battle that was going on in terms of what unionism should mean.
And so today, Bill, as we look forward, and we only have a few minutes left, and then this really incredible narrative that you're laying out, I know you feel that black labor is not only essential, the labor movement and black labor, but there are some areas in particular that you think are most promising. Would you sort of share your ideas along those lines?
One of the things that I've been pushing for years, going back to when I worked at the AFL-CIO, is that let me preface it by saying this. In the 1940s, the CIO launched a Southern organizing drive called Operation Dixie, and it failed. It failed for a whole host of reasons, including anti-communism within it, within the campaign, a failure to tackle racism, a number of other things. And at that point, most of organized labor, in effect, abandoned organizing the South, although some unions did continue to do some level of organizing, like 1199 and AFSCME, they did some Southern organizing. Not on the scale that needed to happen, but they did some. In the 90s, one of the things that I was pushing was for a major Southern organizing drive that focused on the public sector. Because if you look at the public sector in the South, one of the things is there's large numbers of African-American workers. You have in most state legislatures black legislative caucuses,
right,
that are progressive and show a willingness in many cases to align themselves with the objectives of labor. And in order to, if you think about a major public sector organizing drive, you're going to need to shift power in government, you're going to probably need to shift laws, And an alliance is right there to be made. Plus, it would necessitate a massive community engagement. So I've always thought that this should be where organized labor really pushes forward. The other thing that is critical right now is organizing the unemployed. And right. Despite, you know, the reports that we got the other day about people being hired, the reality is that when you factor in discouraged workers, people have dropped off the screen, we're still talking about an unemployment rate that I believe is somewhere between around 18%. And it's really substantial. And we all know that workers are suffering. The problem is that unemployed people tend to suffer in silence unless they get organized. And I think that there's lessons to be learned from the 1930s. And that's where groups like the National Black Workers Center Project, I think, become very important, that they and others really should be organizing the black unemployed to fight for jobs, to build mutual assistance, to oppose further efforts at austerity, which is being pushed by the Republicans and unfortunately by some Democrats as a solution to our current economic problems. So I think that those are at least two areas where a strategic intervention by black workers could really make a difference.
And Bill, how much resonance are these ideas sort of gaining in relationship to the National Workers Center, the various major labor organizations, or maybe some of the lesser known labor organizations in the country?
It's hard to say. In part because let me put it like this. There's no effort that I understand, at least that I am aware of right now, to organize on a massive scale in the South. Unions are complaining about the economic picture, the cuts, et cetera, and all of which is true, but it's always been true, and there's always excuses for not organizing the South and not organizing black workers. But the other part of this that we have to be honest about is that we scare white people. And one of the problems in organized labor has been this sort of what I call the fear of the Mau Mau. The fear of the maroon, this fear that we African American workers will at some point rise up and do something completely out of the control of whites. Right. And this may sound really bizarre, but this fear is there. Right. And it's one of the things that I think we've got to speak honestly about, and this is a good moment, because of all of the discussions about racial justice in the aftermath of the lynchings that took place in April and May and the murder of George Floyd and subsequent murders, we're able to have greater discussions now. But those discussions in labor need to be not simply about how labor should support the Black Lives Matter movement externally, but how they need to look internally to transform themselves, and not just on race, but to transform themselves into 21st century organizations.
Well, Bill Fletcher, that hit right on the exit point. Really, really, really appreciate the information. Bill, how can people get in touch with you in terms of the books that you've written and your lectures and sure. various other information that you can share with our audience?
So there's a few different ways. So my personal website is BillFletcherJr.com. It's all one word. I'm also the executive editor of a developing web magazine called GlobalAfricanWorker.com. Those are the two best ways to reach me.
BillFletcherJr.com?
BillFletcherJr.com, right? Junior,
okay.
J-R.
All right. And the second one is?
Global African Worker, all one word, .com.
Well, Bill, really enjoyed and appreciate you taking time today to come and talk about this subject. I really wanted to have a Black Labor discussion on Black Labor Day. I think we ought to appropriate this day and have these conversations. So I thank you so much for, you know, taking time to help us carry the conversation.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right, Bill Fletcher and Bill Lucy, two great labor leaders laying out their perspectives. And once again, you'll be able to check them both out this evening, 7 o'clock in a few hours on the IBW website, ibw21.org, session on the theft of Black labor and extraction of Black wealth, how the oppression and exploitation of Black people contributed to the making of capitalism in America. Again, that will be on this evening at 7 o'clock p.m., www.ibw21.org, or just go to ibw21.org. Now, quickly, I also want to remind people of the Community Chaos Listening Line that the Black Family Summit of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century has put together for essential workers and first-line responders, and all that that means in terms of people who are just anxious and having issues about should we go to school, should we not go to school, what's happening with the violence in our community, all these COVID-related kinds of difficulties that we're experiencing. We have a listening line for that purposes. We can refer you to various kinds of services. It's supported by our partner here at WBAI. The number to call is 877-719-1117. That's 877-719-1117. Now, I also want to end where I began. There was a urgent appeal made, and it's continuing to be made during the course of the day by our program director and general manager, about the need to raise $8,000 a day in order to keep WBAI alive and thriving. Now, an effort was made to take us away from just hearing this constant, you know, week after week of pledging an innovative structure to try to, you know, have it staggered. Right? It'll take some time to perfect that, but that's in an effort to try to make it a more pleasant experience. But at the end of the day, pleasant or unpleasant, the reality is those resources are needed. Freedom is not free. Going back to my old sort of bringing up in the NAACP many, many years ago in Youngstown, Ohio. So we need your support. I pledged and will pay this evening $300, asking as many people as possible who can match that at 100 to do so, by calling 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Support WBAI. It is urgently needed. It is our fortress for resistance and transformation. This is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels saying we appreciate you tuning in to this special Black Labor Day program, and we look forward to seeing you again here next week here on WBAI 99.5 FM in collaboration with YCRadio.org. We'll see you next week.